For decades, just the mention of Ireland evoked images of wild, rolling landscapes, devout Catholicism, a belief in spirits and fairies, great poetry and theater, hardscrabble lives, and an inclination toward merrymaking. But that picture changed somewhat about 15 years ago during a period of rapid economic growth and changing cultural values. In 2000, journalist David Monaghan and his wife and three children moved from their home in rural Connecticut to the city of Cork, Ireland, and his most recent book, Ireland Unhinged, Encounters with a Widely Changed Country, chronicles the effects of that rapid rise and equally speedy collapse, and at the same time chronicles his family's emigre experiences. It's published by Council Oaks Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings David Monaghan to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thank you very much for having me.
What prompted your family's move to Ireland in the first place?
Well, it was a bit of a lark, you might say, to start with. We thought we might go over for a year, sort of sabbatical, midlife, you know, adventure, which many people talk about, the idea, well, I'd love to go to France or Ireland or someplace. We said, well, okay, we're actually going to do it.
But then you decided Cork, not Dublin.
Yes,
so you must have had some kind of a goal in mind.
Well, we've been living in northwestern Connecticut in a small town, a lovely small town called Cornwall. And
with the famous bridge.
That's correct, the famous covered bridge. And so we were used to a more rural style of existence, not the big city life, which years ago we did live in New York. So we thought we'd go to some in-between type of world, which is Cork. And what happened was, as I chronicle in Ireland Unhinged, is we got there in that summer of 2000 and just started meeting these marvelous characters, these very open people generally, and had a lot of laughs, and one year became two, and found a certain amount of renewal and inspiration through our daily lives that I suppose in midlife had started to wane. And so all of a sudden, one year was 2 years, and now it's 11 years, and we're still there.
And your kids love it?
They love it.
They're the ones who are most likely to resist, aren't they?
Well, I think it'd be very dangerous to move with kids later in their teenage years. Ours were pretty young when they're still flexible, so they become sort of half Irish themselves, but they're also half American. So you always have that dichotomy. But they've warmed to the place greatly. Yes.
You compare Cork to New Orleans. In what ways are they similar?
People know how to live for the moment and to laugh and to sing. And there's a great spontaneity, and there's a sense of independence. There's a sense of being a city apart, which I think people in New Orleans have, where Dublin is almost like a rival race, you know, to people in Cork. And they're very proud of themselves and very independent.
Well, the most famous book about an American moving to Ireland is from the late 50s, but J.P. Dunleavy wrote The Ginger Man about Dublin.
Yeah.
And even there, he was kind of like a fish out of water.
Yes, but he loved every moment of it. In Ireland, in Hinged, I profile meeting a great number of people across the land as I started looking for what is the essence of Ireland in this radically changing, this roller coaster, wild west of capitalism times that existed just a couple of years ago. And so one of the people I gravitated to seeing is this man has become a great recluse, J.P. Dunleavy, but his Ginger Man sold 60 million copies, and I think he's done as much to shape an earlier generation's picture of Ireland as anyone.
It was interesting. He's been on this show, and I met him before, actually, in London when he'd moved to London because he had found Ireland a little too restricting. Then he moved back. Most of Western Europe had been going through an economic boom for some time. What had been holding Ireland back?
What had been holding Ireland back?
It finally did have that boom about 15 years ago.
Well, it had no industrial infrastructure, no industrial base. Cities came to Ireland, in a sense, as late as any place in Europe. It was more of a nomadic land, and of course, there was the whole issue of the English domination for 700 to 800 years. Whether that held it back or not is debatable, but it's a new country. It's really only, what, 90 years old now. And
But you also talk about the pace there. You say that the pace, at least in Cork, was even slower than rural Connecticut. And I wonder if that was one of the things that held it back. Because to have an economic boom, you have to have people who are working fairly efficiently, don't you?
Well, of course you do. One of the good things the Irish government started really in the 70s and intensified over the next 20 years is to push higher education. And there has been this gradual and consistent change to more concern for efficiency and productive enterprises. And so,
has that been working?
Well, all these American and also German corporations primarily moved in with this scheme that the Irish came up with, is having about the lowest tax rate for corporations in Europe, and saying we have this young, vital, educated workforce. And yes, it did work. That was one of the first levers of the Irish boom. And of course, joining the EU was a tremendous boost as well. So everything just grew exponentially there in this incredible 15-year period that is unfortunately now busted.
And you repeatedly use the phrase the Celtic Tiger when you are talking about the effects of economic growth in Ireland. Can you explain that term and its roots?
Well, that's a root from some banker somewhere. I think it's modeled after one of the Asian tigers. That was kind of a cliche that was knocking around the banking world in the 1990s. But it was the idea that this was indeed the fastest growing economy in Europe and one of the fastest growing economies in the world. For nearly 15 years, the Irish claimed they had more millionaires per capita than the United States or England or really any country. They were buying Mercedes-Benzes faster at a higher rate than anyone in Europe, and helicopters, and it was this incredible transformation of a formerly poor economy, and then they went too far with it.
Fueled to some degree by that low tax rate? I mean, a low tax rate also means the government gets less money, doesn't it?
Well, I suppose it does, but when you have 25% of the economy being created overnight by new companies coming in and providing all this employment, it works out in the end, I think.
Did coming from the United States and from the New York metropolitan area in particular color your perceptions of growth and supposed progress in Ireland?
Yeah. Well, the experience was rather amazing at first to see this country that I had been a student in the 1970s. It was formerly so much poorer and so much more lackadaisical, if you will. Suddenly seeing these parades of SUVs in a country with no snow driving past every afternoon when the Irish version of the Yummy Mummies were picking up their kids from private schools, which suddenly became so much more in demand. And the value of houses tripled and quadrupled during this boom, and now nobody knows what the value of any house is, so everything has changed again radically.
My guest is David Monaghan, who is the author of three books, Journey into the Heart, Jaywalking with the Irish, and now Ireland Unhinged, Encounters with a Wildly Changing Country. It's published by Council Oak Books. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. So you're in Cork, but then you write about your growing disillusionment with modern Ireland, and you and your wife bought a home in the country to escape the pace of Cork during these boom times. What did you hope the new community would provide for you and your family? Were you looking for something like what John Wayne found in John Ford's The Quiet Man?
Well, I couldn't exactly agree to that comparison, but
that's a fantasy Ireland, isn't it?
Well, I don't know about a fantasy Ireland, but there was such a incredible shift in values and behavior going on during this boom that we and many others began wondering about what's the essence, what is enduring. And, and my book, Ireland Unhinged, is in part a search for that. And I guess one of the ways that we tried to probe deeper is buying this cottage by a beautiful river called the Blackwater in a village called Ballyduff. And in fact, in some of these rural pockets, there was much less radical change, and there is much more of the native friendliness and easy storytelling, say. And
was there resistance to the change?
I don't know that there is resistance. It's just they weren't around so much money and had more of a natural pace remaining. So we went from we did move there. Pardon me, I'm hoarse from speaking 10 days in a row. And then also traveling around the country to meet these remarkable people. But
people also in areas that are where the culture is entrenched usually resent the newcomers. They feel that they're going to change everything. Were you welcomed as an American family coming into this this rather quiet area?
Yes, really rather entirely, because it's not like there's some invasion of people. It's also sort of a unique village and a unique place near Lismore, and which is famous for its castle, where there has been 800 years of transition from the Normans and the Vikings and the British and so on, moving in and out. And there's rather international populations scattered around there, as indeed there is a lot of the west of Ireland, which is part of the fun and interest of the country if you go to the right places.
You write about the death of some major cultural pillars, the virtual disappearance of the Irish language, for example. Has there been an effort to protect and preserve that and other hallmarks of Irish culture?
With the language in particular, there's been an enormous effort, which has been going on for decades, where every child in the Irish educational system, both in the primary and secondary level, is required to take the Irish language, but for up to 12 years and pass exams in it. But that doesn't mean they speak it very often. There are only certain pockets in the country where the language survives. And you know, it is an international country now with the television and pop music and everything, saturating the young people.
So, is it as deeply religious as it was in the past?
Well, one of the most fascinating things about Ireland is it's a land still to this day, is it's a land of so many contrasts. And so you can say one thing about it that is true in a certain place and go down the road and it's different all over again. In the cities, there's been a tremendous fall off in religious observance. In rural communities, I mean, you are noted if you do not appear at Mass on Sunday.
And religion still plays a major role in the culture of Northern Ireland. Did you visit Northern Ireland?
I had a fascinating trip to Belfast and around other parts of the north, where I stayed in a monastery called the Clonard Monastery, because I had met the rector, and he invited me to go there. And this is just off the Falls Road in West Belfast, which was the epicenter of the Troubles, the Catholic Rising and the reaction, violent reactions from the Protestant community. The Shankill, but in the middle of this was this rather ordinary-looking monastery where there's a couple of inspired men who began to put people together. In the beginning of this whole peace process, the end of this basically warfare of the North began in a monastery where this priest Jerry Reynolds would read John Donne poems with these rival parties to settle them down and give them a word of peace. So this is a fascinating way to get into the North. And again, I met quite a number of people who would speak with tremendous openness about the changes.
Earlier, in talking about the economic boom, you said they went too far with the economic growth. How can you go too far with economic growth?
Well, I watched the movie Wall Street on the plane coming over 10 days ago when Michael Douglas said, speculation is the mother of all evils at one point. And a country that is kind of feeding on its own pipe dreams of having seen property values triple and quadruple in 15 years is seeing an economic bubble that is almost certain to burst. And that is the biggest thing that happened uniquely to Ireland as opposed to what's happened in Wall Street here. And
people moving to the cities, I'm assuming. There was more gentrification, which is always a controversial subject.
Well, there was some of that, but basically people who had been formerly farmers started buying each other's fields and building strings of houses on the idea that some magical new race might appear and buy these things that were not needed. There's 80,000 houses in Ireland right now that are uninhabited, brand new houses. And that's like somebody built 800,000 houses in the United States that are uninhabited and unneeded. Same with hotels and many other things. It was just speculative fever.
Did the bubble burst suddenly, or was there kind of a gradual decline?
I think the bubble burst like the day after Lehman Brothers busted in a way, and all of a sudden, somebody said to me that the value of the Irish stock market went down 15% in the next day, and the traders, the stock traders, would say, nobody's interested in Ireland anymore. And then things went into a free fall, as they did here. But in Ireland, it's more severe, actually. And
well, there are only six banks, right? I mean, so if a bank fails, and all of the banks are too big to fail.
That's a very controversial question, in my opinion. And to most people in Ireland, the government agreed to bail out all the major banks without having any concept of how deeply they were in debt. And that's why there's 85 billion euros had to be recruited from the International Monetary Fund and the EU and even Great Britain. And there's this sense of the Irish sovereignty being lost and many basic things being dictated by foreign powers for several years to come. But there's a great resilience in the people, and so we're all hopeful that eventually things are going to turn around, but they're tough times.
Well, as Ireland's economy was bottoming out, you asked your wife if she wished she were back in America. What did she say?
Well, I think the answer would always be ambivalent for each one of us and our family. We are Americans, and it's been wonderful to be here in New York and see, which I think I've forgotten what a friendly place it is, and to travel through Connecticut and Boston. And this is our old stomping ground. And there's part of us that would like to be here, but we're kind of citizens of each place at the same time.
Well, as an established writer, aren't you somewhat less vulnerable to the ups and downs of an economy? I mean, you're not going to a daily
job. I've never heard of a writer like that before.
Well, but you're not going to a regular job. You're not going to be laid off. You may find it harder to get some things published. But in the end, people are always going to want to know what's going on.
Well, there's some truth in that, but I think every major publisher in America even knows that there are harder times for writers. So I keep writing about Ireland. It seems to be an insatiable market, particularly on this St. Patrick's Day, and I keep finding funny things to get into and curious people and lovely people.
And happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Same to you, Leonard. Thank you very much.
David Madigan's book, published by Council Oak Books, is called Ireland Unhinged: Encounters with a Wildly Changing Country. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. My pleasure.